Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This month marks the second anniversary of President Obama signing the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, known to most of its opponents as Obamacare. The new law was intended to extend health care coverage to tens of millions of previously uninsured Americans. Some provisions already are in effect, and others will be rolled out over the course of years. Beginning next week, the U.S. Supreme Court holds 3 days of constitutional arguments about the law. At stake, the individual requirement to buy health insurance, and possibly the entire health care law itself. Later on, we'll hear from an OSU Wexner Medical Center administrator about what the key provisions of the Federal Health Care Reform Act mean for individuals and the health care system in Ohio. And we'll catch up on Ohio's efforts, or not, to establish a state health insurance exchange by 2014. Joining us now by phone from Lexington, Virginia, to preview the issues before the U.S. Supreme Court is Timothy Jost. He's a professor of law at Washington and Lee University School of Law. Professor Jost is the author of Health Law. It's a casebook used widely throughout the United States in teaching health law. His most recent book is Healthcare at Risk, a critique of the consumer-driven movement. He was a professor of law at Ohio State University from 1982 to 1992. So welcome back to Ohio, and welcome to our program, Tim.
Thank you. I'm also continue to be a loyal Buckeye fan, although it wasn't that easy this last year.
Okay. Question for our listeners. Have you benefited yet from the provisions that have been rolled out in the Healthcare Overhaul Act? What if those benefits go away? Give us a call and tell us your story, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page or tweet me at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Tim, the Supreme Court in five and a half hours of oral argument will consider four questions. The first is whether Congress exceeded its constitutional authority in requiring virtually all Americans to have basic health coverage. The second is if it's unconstitutional, does the rest of the law stand? The third is does the law impose unconstitutional conditions on the states by requiring them to increase their payments into Medicaid by 2017? And the fourth is it premature to decide the first three questions? And I wondered, why don't they ask the fourth question first?
Well, actually, it is the question they're going to ask first.
Okay.
Because that's what's scheduled for the first day of oral argument.
Okay.
And the issue there is that there is a very old statute, actually, 19th century statute, that prohibits people from suing to challenge a federal tax until the tax is actually assessed and collected, and it's there for pretty obvious reasons. You don't want everybody to go into court immediately when Congress passes a new tax law and start suing before you actually see who's going to be taxed and how much they're going to be taxed for. But the minimum coverage requirement, the requirement that everyone have health insurance, which actually is subject to many exceptions. There's an awful lot of people it doesn't apply to. But anyway, the penalty through which that is enforced is found in the tax code. And so the argument is until that penalty is actually imposed on somebody, which wouldn't happen until 2015, the court doesn't have jurisdiction to hear the challenge. So that is an important question which they're going to have to decide.
Is it a common question that goes before the U.S. Supreme Court?
There have been quite a number of other cases involving the what's called the Tax Anti-Injunction Act, but it rarely is raised in a question in a case of this magnitude.
My guest is Timothy Jost. He's a professor of law at Washington and Lee University School of Law. We're talking about doing a little preview of what's coming up next week when the U.S. Supreme Court spends 5.5 hours of an oral argument to consider the Health Care Reform Act, the Health Care Overhaul, or Obamacare, depending on where you're sitting. Tim, the court selected as a vehicle a challenge brought by Florida and 15 other states, as well as the National Federation of Independent Business. It's the biggest case and the only one of the four cases ruled on by lower appeals courts to date in which any part of the law was struck down. Why this case?
Well, actually, there are now 26 states involved.
Okay.
Although some of those states, it's the governor, some it's the attorney general, and in a few of them, the attorney general or the governor there's an attorney general or a governor on the other side as well. So, but I believe that the court picked that particular vehicle for two reasons. One is because it does involve so many states, and of course, states are very important, and the Supreme Court pays attention to what they say. The other and perhaps most important reason is because, as you said, it is the only appellate court decision that has held any part of the law to be unconstitutional, and you simply can't have a situation where the law is unconstitutional in Florida but constitutional in the rest of the country. And therefore, the court really had to review that decision if the law is to stand.
And the question is whether or not the Congress exceeded its constitutional authority?
Yeah, that's the main question with respect to the minimum coverage requirement, which most people call the individual mandate. Did Congress have the authority to adopt that law? And the federal government is arguing that it does have that authority, both under its power to regulate interstate commerce and its power to collect taxes, because once again the mandate is enforced through a tax or a penalty, and that's of course the argument: is it a tax or is it a penalty, and doesn't make any difference. And then both of those powers are supplemented by the Necessary and Proper Clause, which says Congress can do what is necessary and proper to implement its other powers. And that's a very important argument in this case, that Congress is trying to reform health insurance markets in the United States. It is the biggest sector of our economy, health is, and therefore it is subject to congressional regulation. But to make the reforms of the health insurance market work, you need to have healthy people as well as unhealthy people buying health insurance. And so that's why the requirement is there.
Also, if it is unconstitutional, does the rest of the law stand?
Well, the 11th Circuit said yes. The 11th Circuit said, and again, that's the only federal appellate court to hold the law unconstitutional. The 11th Circuit said that one provision is unconstitutional, all of the rest of the statute stays in place. The states are arguing that if that provision falls, if that requirement falls, the entire rest of the statute falls with it, which is an interesting argument because it implicitly concedes the federal government's argument that the minimum coverage requirement is necessary and proper to make the rest of the statute work. The states are essentially saying, yeah, it is, and therefore if it falls, the rest of the statute falls with it. And it'll be interesting to see what the justices make of that essential concession of the states. But in any event, the federal government is arguing, well, if the minimum coverage requirement goes, then it's going to be pretty hard to make a couple of other provisions of the statute, specifically the provision that requires insurers to insure everybody who wants to purchase insurance from them and to charge them essentially the same rate with some adjustments, that those provisions depend on the minimum coverage requirement. And so if it falls, they fall as well. But all of the rest of the statute stays. And then the court appointed a special counsel, an amicus, to argue that the position of the 11th Circuit, that all of the rest of the statute stays in place. Much of the statute is already in place, number one, so obviously it doesn't depend on the minimum coverage requirement to work. And furthermore, many of the provisions have absolutely nothing to do with it. Like the provision that requires fast food restaurants to post the caloric content of their menu items, nothing to do with the minimum coverage requirement. And I would be amazed if, I think most legal observers would be, if the court strikes down the entire rest of the statute.
You mentioned earlier on when you were talking about the prohibition that to rule on a tax until the tax assessed has been collected or has been assessed and collected. And you mentioned the minimum regulations or the minimum requirements and that there are many exceptions to those minimum requirements. Is that a factor in any of this?
You know, it really hasn't been part of the public discussion, and that fascinates me. The statute itself is written very broadly, and there are a few small exceptions, like the Amish or people who have a religious objection to purchasing health insurance. But the requirement is enforced through the penalty. And to say there's a requirement without any sanction, it's not much of a requirement. And the penalty, if you look at it, doesn't apply to many, many Americans. Basically, it doesn't apply to anyone whose income is below the filing limit, which is most people whose income is below the poverty level. And it doesn't apply to people who cannot afford health insurance for 8% or less of their income. And given how expensive health insurance is, if you have somebody out in the individual market who doesn't have insurance through their employment and can't get one of the premium tax credits to reduce their liability below 8%, you're talking about people who are families that are earning $150,000, $160,000 a year. And so most middle-income Americans who can't get insurance through their job or through a public program or subsidy aren't covered by the individual mandate.
When we were talking about whether or not if the court invalidates the statute in part, if that happens, if it should happen, or if parts of the statute are invalidated, for instance, people to age 26 are able to stay on their parents' health insurance plans. How is there any precedent for something like that, sort of that take back of something like that? And does that play into the argument or play into the discussion?
It's a good question, and frankly, I can't think of any precedent, although there have been, of course, a number of laws declared unconstitutional over the years and many more before the 1930s. I think that raises a very important problem. I have a son who is 22 years old, who has graduated from college, who has a very serious medical condition, and is getting help because of the Affordable Care Act, would not be insured otherwise. I hate to think of what would happen if he would lose his insurance coverage. He certainly wouldn't be able to buy any right now, given his medical condition. Now, a number of states have either adopted the provisions of the Affordable Care Act or already had similar provisions on the books. And in those states, many of the protections would continue to exist. But in states that haven't adopted those laws, I would imagine he and now there are 2.5 million young adults who are covered under the statute. Many of them would be thrown off of their health insurance if this law were found unconstitutional.
I wanted to ask you about the significance of the fact that the court allocated 5.5 hours for oral argument. I could probably talk about this for 5.5 hours, so I'm not arguing about whether it's chattable or not, but it is considered one of the longest, if not the longest, length of argument in history in the United States Supreme Court. So why 5.5? Why not 5 or 6? Why didn't they round it up or round it down?
Yeah, well, actually, they did increase it to 6.
Oh, okay.
A week or two ago.
Great minds.
It's because there are 4 issues, and they want to make sure that there is adequate time to cover each of the issues. And yes, as far as I can find out, it is a record in modern times. They used to, back in the old days, argue for days, but in recent history, it is a record. And again, it's just because of the very important issues and the fact that there are 4 issues that they're considering and not just 1.
Well, Tim Jost, I want to thank you for joining us today. It's been very helpful.
Thank you for the invitation. Good to talk to people in Ohio again.
Timothy Jost, he's a professor of law at Washington and Lee University School of Law. He's author of Healthcare at Risk, A Critique of the Consumer-Driven Movement, and a former professor at the Moritz College of Law. Thanks again, and stay with us. We're going to continue our conversation about the U.S. Supreme Court arguments coming up next week on the affordable health care law. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
This is 89.7 NPR News. WOSU Public Media presents Chefs in the City 2012, featuring celebrity chef Hubert Keller, along with a elite group of Central Ohio culinary greats. Be sure to like Chefs in the City on Facebook or visit WOSU.org/chefs to see our Chefs Feature of the Week. 71 degrees with partly sunny skies in downtown Columbus. We're warming up to a high of 84 today. Clear skies tonight, a low of 60, and a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms for Thursday, and some more sunshine as well, a high of 81. A few clouds Thursday night, a low of 61 degrees. This is 89.7 NPR News, and All Sides continues.
This month marks the second anniversary of President Obama signing the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, known to its opponents as Obamacare. Next week, the U.S. Supreme Court begins hearing constitutional arguments which will decide the fate of key provisions of the federal health care reform law, or maybe the whole kit and caboodle. Joining us now to talk about provisions of federal health care reform already in effect and provisions yet to come is Jerry Friedman. He's health policy advisor and director of government affairs at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. Jerry also serves as associate vice president in the Office of Health Sciences, and he's the former president of the Ohio Children's Hospital Association. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us to talk about the Kasich administration's response to federal health care reform is Karen Kassler. She's the bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Karen.
Good morning.
And once again, the question for our listeners, have you or somebody you're related to benefited yet from the provisions that have been rolled out in the health care overhaul law? What if those benefits go away? Give us a call and tell us your story. 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can go to our Facebook page, post your question or comment there, or tweet me at @AnnFisherWOSU. So here we go. If Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor, in a column published in the Dayton Business Journal, it might have been published elsewhere, but that's the copy I have, in September, said that the health insurance reform law forces insurance companies to include coverage for benefits you may not want, she notes. For example, maternity and newborn care. What if you don't have children or don't want children? So why have this one-size-fits-all approach, she asked. She happened to pick maternity, so I checked that out in my own health insurance with OSU. And inpatient maternity services are covered 100% after a $350 copay. I'm not having any more children, but I have the coverage. Is this the one-size-fits-all approach that she's talking about? Jerry Friedman?
Well, I think that is a view of health care that doesn't really contemplate the realities of insurance. At its base, what we're trying to do, I think, through health care reform is create a risk pool that is large enough to balance out the costs of the sick care system that we have. So I think if you go back and look at what we have now, we have people who are insured who end up paying a premium for coverage that is worked through the black box of healthcare providers to accommodate for the costs of those individuals who do not have coverage, who are essentially showing up at the emergency department or for whom there is underinsurance, where a number of the activities that they need are not covered. So the attempt here really is to create a risk pool to bring in the healthy folks and have them contribute to the system on the premise that at some point in the future they will need that support. And so the argument, as Professor Jost talked about it, is caught up with that kind of activity where we're trying to create this broad pool to balance the risks of the cost of those folks who are ill.
Just want to let our listeners know that we did request an interview for this program with Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor, who's also the director for the Ohio Department of Insurance and therefore is in charge of Ohio's adoption or how the new law is manifested in Ohio. We also, when they were not able to accommodate us that way, we asked for any spokesperson from the State Department of Insurance. They didn't have anybody available. We also requested Greg Moody, who's the director of the Governor's Office of Health Transformation. They also didn't have anybody to join us for the show. We'll continue to request interviews with all those people because we know it would enlighten the conversation a great deal. Karen Kassler, uncertainty seems to be a big plank. I have the talking points that Lieutenant Governor uses in a lot of her speeches that she gives around the state a lot about this issue.
I've seen her give a couple of these speeches, yes.
I wish I had some audio of that. I would use it today. Uncertainty seems to be a big plank in her explanation for why more has not been done in Ohio, especially when it comes to the health insurance exchange operation. They say that the federal government keeps changing deadlines and that its prescription for the reforms at the administrative level remains very unclear. What about that?
And that's exactly what, every time I've done a story about this, that's the answer I've gotten. And as recently as yesterday, Greg Moody was testifying before the House Finance Committee on Governor Kasich's budget review plan. And he was asked, because he was standing there, I think more than anything else, by a Democratic lawmaker, hey, what's going on with the health care exchanges? And, you know, Moody said, well, those aren't in the budget review. But he gave an answer that I actually transcribed, and once again, it's very vague. There's a lot of reference to regulations and things that we're still trying to figure out, and we're still trying to follow deadlines that keep shifting. But there was no answer from Greg Moody about this is the date on which we are going to set up an exchange. This is where we are in the exchange setting up process, or we're not setting up an exchange. And you also have the other half of this, the folks who were behind issue 3 that was on the ballot last fall, the Ohio health care reform or Ohio health care freedom amendment. They are saying and have said that if indeed the state does go ahead and try to start setting up these exchanges, there's a possibility they may sue under this constitutional amendment that voters approved last fall that said that no government system can require anybody to participate in a health care arrangement. And so it's really, really very uncertain. You're exactly right in using that word, I think, in terms of what the state is doing right now to comply with this law while we wait to hear what the U.S. Supreme Court says about it.
Now, 14 states have gone ahead, for instance, with the insurance exchanges. Any sense about what they're seeing that the state of Ohio is not seeing in terms of implementation?
Well, now, Ohio is one of the states that's actually involved in the lawsuit in U.S. Supreme Court. And so that may be one reason why they've decided not to set up an exchange.
But we don't know.
We don't know. And, you know, I think there was a lot of concern. I mean, you know, when Attorney General Mike DeWine started running for office in 2010, this was the first thing he said he was going to do. He was going to join the lawsuit against the Affordable Health Care Act. And so I think that's one reason why there's kind of this wait and see attitude of, you know, the Supreme Court is going to have to decide this entire law, portions of this law, whatever the court does end up doing. Let's wait and see what the guidelines are going to be after the court makes its decision, because otherwise, I think maybe there's an attitude of this would be an exercise that would not go anywhere if indeed the law is struck down. I don't know, though. I'm conjecturing a little bit.
From Andrew on Facebook, he says, I didn't have a job right away after college. This law allowed me to stay on my mom's health insurance plan. And Janine in Marysville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Janine.
Yes. I wanted to tell you that my this law really helped me, in that my husband died suddenly, and we were unable to continue the $1,500 COBRA payment on his health care. And my daughter had epilepsy, so I tried to get individual health insurance, but no one would take her with her epilepsy. So I was able to get on the high-risk pool and able to get very good comprehensive health care for her for a reasonable price. And so I'm really grateful to this program.
And what if it went away? What would you do?
I don't know what I don't know what I would do. I don't know. I have no idea.
Okay. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you. Bye.
Yeah.
And I think you have some folks who are supporters of the law saying and pointing to stories exactly like that and saying if indeed the law is thrown out or if there's an attempt to repeal it or, you know, anything that could dismiss the law, that you're going to have stories like that. That, you know, studies and polls have shown that people don't like the law, but they like provisions of the law. And this whole idea of staying on your parents' health insurance until you're in your 20s and these sorts of ideas, I guess, you know, some polls have shown people really like this. But then when asked, do you like the federal health care law, polls are really conflicted on where people stand on it. And this is, you know, there was a lot of fun made of Nancy Pelosi when she said we have to pass the law to find out what's in the law. That's true with every piece of legislation. It really is. And because you can pass the law, but then when the rules are written to actually put the law in force.
Very different process.
It is. And so that's what we've been finding out over the last 2 years here is what is in this law. Some people like a lot of the stuff in the law. Some people don't like stuff in the law. And so this is a discovery process in a way. And then, of course, when we go to the Supreme Court, the whole, you know, issue comes out. And I think it's interesting. I've heard about some people who are scalping tickets to go see.
I was going to say, have you carved out time in your schedule?
I want to watch it. Yeah, absolutely, because I'm a geek like that. But there's a lot of folks in Washington who are, you know, paying big money to try to see the arguments for this case, which I think is fascinating.
And
yes, Jerry Friedman.
And, you know, when you talk about the lieutenant governor saying that there's uncertainty, there is certainty. The certainty is what we have today. Ohio State University hospitals, our affiliates at Children's Hospitals, the other hospitals in the state are providing care, but they're providing care in the most expensive and the most inappropriate place for people who do not have coverage. That is the emergency department. That is the only place within our health care system where people are guaranteed that they will receive health care without regard to their ability to pay. The cost of that care is being borne by people who are purchasing insurance. The cost of that care is being borne by governments in terms of...
And that's because the hospitals are passing along the cost that they bear to people who can afford to pay for it.
Right. You know, we sometimes say that as a not-for-profit, we don't run it as a business, but we have to run it like a business. We have to meet payroll. We have to cover the costs of the supplies. Those costs of care for people without coverage have to be paid for by somebody. And the people paying for it are the people who are purchasing insurance and the government taxpayers who are underwriting the cost of Medicare and Medicaid.
Dave in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Ann.
You're welcome.
You know, you asked if we've got some benefit, and my daughter came out of college and hit 25 and lost health insurance, and then they passed the law, and I've been able to have her covered for a couple of years. And so we've been beneficiaries already. But beyond that, further to Jerry Friedman's point, my comment is this. We use the term insurance. And I think that sometimes vocabulary gets in the way, because in reality, what we have in place is not healthcare insurance in the sense that most insurance covers catastrophes that are unlikely to happen. What we have in place instead is a healthcare system where we have, in essence, prepaid savings to cover the known eventuality that we're going to need care, ranging from daily, you know, regular coverage to catastrophic events. And I think that if we were just to simply start by saying, geez, this isn't insurance. This isn't like maybe I'll have a house fire, but probably I won't. This is, I've got to pay in advance for something I know I'm going to need. We may be able to come to a more reasonable conversation about the need to reform our healthcare system. And I'd love to hear some comments about that.
Jerry Friedman, you know, you brought up the fact that we have a sick care system.
Right. Yeah, the nature of insurance, because I think insurance is intertwined in this arena. I mean, the medicine is a business. It's actually two businesses. There's the business of medicine and there's the business of insurance. Medicine treats you when you're sick. Insurance loves you when you're not. Insurance as a philosophy is risk averse. Insurance doesn't assume risk. Insurance spreads risk. So there is not an insurance objective in terms of keeping you healthy. What the insurance objective is not having you sick. And that is the fundamental distinction that we have, which is why we have a sick care system. Insurance will pay when you get sick, but insurance does not pay to keep you healthy. And if you think about it, you know, health doesn't happen in the doctor's office. Health is about what you do the other 364 days a year in terms of how you live your life. And so we have an understanding that the things that influence an individual's health status are 90% behavior and lifestyle, genetics, and environment. 10% is access to health care. We are spending 90% of our dollars on that 10% that has the least impact on individuals' health. That's not to say in that very moment that you are ill that medical care isn't important, but part of the reason that our system is unsustainable is that we're just continuing to wait until people get sick. And out there in the culture, we're saying, supersize me. Supersize me. If I have a heart attack, the healthcare system, the medical care system will take care of that. If I need a transplant, we'll take care of that. But there's nothing that's being done on a concerted basis to try to shift those resources into keeping people healthy.
Dave, thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jerry, which provisions that have already taken effect had the most impact on health care at the hospital level? Have you noticed any difference in any way?
Well, there are benefits and burdens. I think the earlier caller did mention the high-risk pool. I think a number of individuals with serious medical conditions who had not been able in the insurance market to get affordable or available insurance have had the benefit of having coverage, and that has, to some degree, minimized that cost of uncompensated care. On the other side, as part of the financing of the health care plan, there have been reductions that have been implemented in terms of our Medicare payment rates. There is a reduction that is going on. There is a provision that will be coming into effect shortly that will essentially penalize hospitals if an individual is readmitted to a hospital for the same problem that they just got discharged for. Nationally, that rate of readmission within 30 days of discharge has been running at about 20%. So one out of every five person who is discharged from the hospital ends up coming back. And in the current system, the hospital gets paid twice. But more importantly, this points out the fact that there's a fragmentation in the system. We have essentially a fee-for-service model. Physicians, hospitals, any of the healthcare professionals who provide care are paid for the care when the patient is right in front of them. So the hospital worries about the patient when they're in the hospital. The physician worries about the patient when they're in the doctor's office. Mm-hmm. That's when they get paid for it. When they leave, it's somebody else's problem. What the healthcare law is trying to move towards is really to build out that continuum of care so that we begin to look not at the fee-for-service and the individual encounter, but that we look at a system of more coordinated care where someone is looking at those handoffs between the various systems. And that is what we are trying now to build towards.
Karen,
that is asynchronous in the sense that we're being asked to move in that direction, but the payment is still paying on a fee-for-service basis.
And interestingly enough, I think that's what the Kasich administration was trying to do with Medicaid, is to move toward a medical home system where people would be kind of tracked, and there would be this idea of you can't just be readmitted over and over and over into the hospital for the same thing, that there needs to be some way to try to help people who are hospitalized in that emergency care situation get what they need and then be released and not keep coming back over and over, because that's where a lot of the expense adds up. And so it's interesting to hear, you know, that the Kasich administration is talking about this with Medicaid and how it would affect, you know, the broader picture, everybody, perhaps under the Affordable Health Care Act if it's upheld.
Absolutely correct. And here in Franklin County, actually, Access Health Columbus has initiated a multi-payer patient-centered medical home initiative, where they actually have developed across a number of different payers, not just Medicaid. And, in fact, Medicaid is not engaged in that at all. These are private payers like Anthem and Humana and OSU Healthcare. OSU Health Plan is actually a participant as well. We currently have 29 patient-centered medical homes, and they do provide this wraparound service that looks at an individual much more comprehensively than was typically available in a traditional doctor's office. And these sites are all certified as meeting a certain standard that was put together by the National Committee on Quality Assurance. And I think there are another 40 practices in the city that are currently undergoing that transformation.
Jerry Friedman, thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Jerry Friedman, he's the health policy advisor and director of government affairs at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. Karen Kassler, as always, thanks for being here for us.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Karen Kassler is the bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. We will continue the conversation when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Looking for an easy way to support 89.7 NPR News? How about joining our Sustaining Giving Program? As a sustainer, your membership never expires. No more reminders in the mail, and your WOSU member card renews annually. The ongoing support of sustaining members saves 89.7 NPR News time and money and helps us focus more of your support on news programming. Make every dollar count and become a sustainer today. Visit WOSU.org/sustainer to sign up.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins with a discussion of Billy Elliot the musical and gender stereotypes facing boys. Stay with us for Hour 2 of All Sides, beginning at 11. And you can listen to 89.7 NPR News anytime by streaming on the web. Just visit WOSU.org and click on the Listen Now button at the top of the page. Listen to local and national news from your computer or mobile device. Just visit WOSU.org. 72 degrees with partly sunny skies. Expect sunshine today and a high of 84 degrees. Clear skies tonight and a low of 60. There is a slight chance of a pop-up shower or thunderstorm Thursday morning, and then sunshine in the afternoon and a high of 81. Clouds Thursday night and a low of 61 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This month marks the second anniversary of President Obama signing the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, known to its opponents as Obamacare. Next week, the U.S. Supreme Court begins hearing constitutional arguments, which will decide the fate of key provisions of the federal health care reform law, maybe the whole thing. Joining us now is Kathleen Geminer. She's from the Universal Healthcare Action Network of Ohio, UCAN, Ohio, where she directs the Ohio Consumers for Health Coverage. It's a coalition of consumer organizations. She has worked in healthcare advocacy and policy analysis for 25 years and was recently appointed as a consumer representative to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. Welcome back, Kathleen.
Good to be here, Ann.
And once again to our listeners, have you benefited yet from the provisions that have been rolled out in the healthcare overhaul? overhaul. What if those benefits go away? Give us a call and tell us what would happen. 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Angie. She says, I have directly benefited from the health care law when I received my first mammography. This is an essential preventive function. I did not have to provide a copay for this service, which is a benefit of the Affordable Care Act. Providing these preventative services without copays will make it easier for individuals to identify problems at an earlier and more treatable stage. I'm thankful for this benefit, not only for myself, but also for my aging parents. Thanks a lot for the email from Angie. So, Kathleen, we want to summarize what's already gone into effect, if we can, and then talk about what's coming up or what's happened. We've already talked about people to the age of 26 can stay on their parents' health insurance plans if they have parents who happen to have health insurance plans. Currently insured people are now eligible for preventive care like the mammography, immunizations, and cancer screenings without deductibles or copayments. That's what Angie was just talking about. Medicare's prescription drug coverage donut hole has been gradually going away.
Absolutely.
I'm still not sure if anyone really understands what the donut hole is, but maybe I'm just speaking for myself. Children with pre-existing conditions are now covered in that high-risk pool, I guess is where that comes from. And eventually adults will be beneficiaries that high-risk pool, but not yet.
Well, adults will not need the high-risk pool because everyone will be covered because insurance companies will no longer be able to exclude people because they have a pre-existing condition.
I guess the idea was they just wanted to get kids covered right away.
That's right. And I think already a couple of the listeners, Anne, have pointed out some of the developments that have really made a difference in people's lives. I note the woman, Janine, who called in, I think from Marysville, who said that her daughter was able to get into the high-risk pool. This high-risk pool or pre-existing condition insurance program, which is its official name, now has in Ohio 2,600 people in it. And these are people who in the past could not get insurance, or if they could, it was at such an exorbitant rate that they couldn't afford to pay for it. And so what the Affordable Care Act did was to make kind of a down payment, if you will, for these adults and children who will be able to get this coverage up until 2014 through the high-risk pool, at which point they will be able to get it in the exchange just like everyone else. There's other benefits. As you noted, the older adults on Medicare and other Medicare beneficiaries are able to start to close off that donut hole. We know that in Ohio, there's over 1 million people that have benefited from the closing of the donut hole, and they have saved up to $95 million. So this is a big deal in Ohio.
Among older people, that's a population that is not a wealthy
Exactly.
sector, right?
And we know that the copays on brand name or the full payment on a brand name drug, which is what someone pays in the donut hole, it's now been reduced to 50%. That's a very big deal for people in Ohio and everywhere in the country. We've seen also, as one of your other guests noted, the preventive care. In new plans, people are now able to get the mammography, whatever, you know, without any copay or being subject to a deductible. And Medicare beneficiaries get that annual exam and those other preventive services without deductibles or copays. So this has been good news for many, many people in Ohio. The young adults, we've now got over 80,000 young adults in Ohio who are on their parents' policies that otherwise would not have been able to.
The Kasich administration has been sending mixed signals, but pretty much Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor, by the way, we did invite her to the show. We also invited a representative of her office in the Department of Insurance. We also invited Greg Moody, the director of the Governor's Office of Health Transformation. We were turned down on all accounts. We have no doubt that they want to be on the show. They just don't have time, so we're going to continue to request their presence. We'd appreciate their input. But anyways, there's been a disconnect. The governor has said, yeah, we're going to go forward with this. Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor has said, no, we don't understand it enough. It's not clear enough. They have not moved forward, at least we do know, on the insurance exchange
Correct.
Component of the law. How complicated is this? And is this a situation where the longer the state waits, the harder it's going to be able to get into it, assuming the U.S. Supreme Court upholds it?
Absolutely. The longer the state waits, the harder it is to meet the deadlines. Right now, by 2013, we are supposed to have passed a law enacting an exchange and have the exchange governing board selected if we're going to be certified by the federal government as able to run our own exchange in 2014. We're not moving quickly in that direction, and so it's more and more looking as though Ohio will have what's going to be called a federally facilitated exchange. Now, we also know that the federal government has extended deadlines for requesting grant money to build the exchange with the full expectation that there are states like Ohio that will not be ready but may decide at a later date they do want to run their own exchanges and then will have the additional money to work with. But in the meantime, Anne, here's what Ohioans are missing because of the position that the Department of Insurance has taken. There are now 34 states that have gotten what's called a level one establishment grant. And these are large grants from the federal government to build the exchange. Michigan, our neighbor to the north, got $9 million from the federal government. Missouri, $20 million. New York, $10 million, and then another grant for $48 million. Oregon, $8 million. Pennsylvania, $33 million. All of these states, some of whom do not agree with the Affordable Care Act. In fact, Michigan is actually one of the 26 that are in the Supreme Court opposing the law. They've moved forward, so they stand to be ready in 2014.
So Ohio has not, because they say regarding the federal grants and the talking points that were shared with us from the Lieutenant Governor's office, they said because our continued work as well as the lack of clarity from the Washington regulators, Ohio, the previous administration, applied for and received one exchange planning grant. Ohio has never returned any exchange planning grant money, contrary to some reports. Ohio did return a consumer assistance grant, not an exchange planning grant, for a couple of reasons, but be that as it may. Where does Ohio stand on this now?
Well, Ohio is referring to its planning grant, but all of these states that I've just mentioned and the amount of money they have are what they call the level one establishment grants, not a grant just to plan for an exchange, but a grant to start building the exchange. You know, an exchange will, think of this, it's a marketplace. It's a place where people can go and buy their insurance virtually on the web or with direct contact with an individual. And it's going to require some pretty high tech to make it easy for all, you know, consumers and small business owners to use. Ohio could have that money in its hand right now, laying that groundwork, and it's not.
Well, could the Strickland administration, the prior administration, have applied for that money and didn't?
No. The Strickland administration applied for planning grant money, and they got it. And they spent some of it, and then the Kasich administration spent the remainder of it, and they did engage the services of the Milliman Corporation to do an analysis mm-hmm. of the market and what it would look like under the market reforms that the Affordable Care Act provides for. As you may be aware, we issued a report last week because we think that there not only are there some things in the Milliman report that we didn't totally agree with, but there's some good things in there that were not getting picked up by the Department of Insurance, and we wanted to make sure that legislators are aware of that. So Strickland administration did all it could. The Kasich administration spent the remainder of that money, but it then proceeded to miss deadlines in last March, a year ago, June, August, December, and this March, when it could have applied for an establishment grant. Now, that money, those grant opportunities will still be there, but will we still be able in the future to get as much money as we might have if we started in right now? And will we be ready to serve the citizens of Ohio in 2014? I think that's the real question that we all need to look at.
Email from a listener writes, if I did not have the health care reform insurance, I don't know what my family and I would do. It would cost $1,500 a month to cover my chronic illnesses, or I would have to file for disability, and I'm not a disabled person. We are the only first world country that does not offer some form of public insurance for all. Email from another listener. A friend of mine, single and self-employed, moved to Massachusetts from Ohio several years ago. Because of a pre-existing condition, she was unable to get health insurance in Ohio. Much to her relief, she discovered that she was able to purchase excellent insurance at a reasonable rate in Massachusetts, thanks to Governor Romney's health care plan. Another positive aspect related to President Obama's affordable health care law.
Well, Ann, you know, Massachusetts, which has been running an exchange now, they call it a connector, but they've been running it for several years. They have reached a point now where 97% of the Massachusetts population has insurance coverage. That's pretty amazing when you think about it. Nationally, 16% of our country is without coverage, and about 12% in Ohio. So this Massachusetts has an amazing accomplishment here.
A lot of people say, though, it's a small state.
It is certainly smaller than Ohio, but it nonetheless has a very mixed population and many of the challenges of rural/urban states. So I would not say that Massachusetts is all that different.
What's next in the rollout? We just have a couple minutes, but what's coming up besides the insurance exchanges and that sort of thing?
Well, certainly when we get to August of this year, we will see some of the preventive services that are particularly important for women will become available, for example, family planning services.
Like the mammography?
Well, the mammography is actually already available
right.
in new plans, but certain things like family planning services will all be available, you know, in August. And then really by a year and a half from now, by October of 2013, we need to be able to start accepting people into the exchange. That's when people will be able to apply to select a plan.
You said if Ohio doesn't do it, the federal government will step in and facilitate one. But at what point does the federal government make that decision that they have to do that? Because, again, time is of the essence.
They will probably make that decision about January 2013, about 9 months from now. So the next 9 months are really important for Ohio. There are a couple bills that have been introduced into the legislature. It would be great if the legislature started to move on those bills or even introduce another bill. There's a lot of people, not just consumers, but small business owners, and I think insurance companies alike, that all would like to see Ohio move forward on its exchange and be ready to be certified by the federal government by 2013.
Well, Kathleen Gemeiner, thanks for joining us again. As usual, we always appreciate your insights.
It's been my pleasure.
Kathleen Gemeiner works for Universal Healthcare Action Network of Ohio and directs the Ohio Consumers for Health Coverage. We'll continue to cover this issue as it evolves next week. Remember, the U.S. Supreme Court will begin hearing 3 days of constitutional arguments about the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. We'll be following up on it then. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.